The views expressed on this podcast are those of the participants, not of Reuters News.
The energy sector was one of the key areas of focus at the COP27 Global Climate Conference in Egypt. But what does the 2022 energy security crisis mean for the companies tasked with decarbonising the global power system over the next few decades? Have a listen to Breaking Views chat with one of the sector's leading lights. Welcome to The Exchange, our weekly interview slot with the movers and shakers of global finance. I'm George Hay, EMEA editor of Breaking Views, the financial commentary arm of Reuters, and I'm coming to you from London. Politicians, investors and scientists have just returned from Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, where they gathered for COP27, the year's premier climate change conference. Just before the event, I caught up with Marco Alvera, boss of Italian gas company Snam between 2016 and 2022. He's now chief executive of Tree Energy Solutions, or TES, which aims to accelerate the energy transition by building some of the world's largest hydrogen projects. And he last year published a well-received book entitled The Hydrogen Revolution. I wanted to ask Marco what war and soaring power costs mean for business people trying to decarbonize at the same time. I also wanted to find out how the bosses of big European industrial companies should be amending their strategies to deal with painfully high power prices, and whether the current mess has any benefits for their counterparts running big renewable energy companies. Meanwhile, how are all these factors likely to change the geopolitical map over the coming decades? Stay tuned to find out his thoughts.
Okay, well, hi Marco, thanks for joining us.
Hi George.
I think to start off, we'll just ask a very simple question. Is the world in a better or worse position on the kind of rate of decarbonisation relative to where we were a year ago at COP26?
Well, the short term is clearly bad because we have coal on the rise everywhere, and it's driven by the lack of alternatives in some European countries, and it's driven by prices in Asia. But I think the medium and long term outlook has much improved. Just because of people really now focusing on the cost of energy and how cheaper some of the alternatives are, and also on security of supply. And I think this both these themes, apart from the horrific summers we've had from a climate point of view, I think all push in the favor of renewables.
Right. So the fact that as you say, some countries like Germany are kind of burning more coal in the short term. Like you would say, like from a kind of energy security point of view, people have worked out or are working out that renewable energy is cheaper in the longer term. And that's so. Do you see kind of evidence on the ground that countries are engaging with renewable energy and the need to roll it out faster more than they were?
I don't see, unfortunately, enough evidence of on the ground activity, because I think most governments are really focused on the next winter. But I see all the analysts and the industry commentators and industry players getting ready for what we expect will be a massive acceleration in the deployment of renewables. The U.S. Took a leapfrog ahead of Europe with the Inflation Reduction Act, and with the Hydrogen Department of Energy of the States has $8 billion of hydrogen hub funding that's going out. Everyone's waiting for Europe's response that will come. And I think we shouldn't forget that China is constantly progressing their climate agenda. So if you ask me which country is progressing the fastest, it's China, because they are continuing to roll out electric vehicles and hydrogen buses, etc.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, you were the boss of chief executive of Snam, the main operator of the transport and dispatching of natural gas in Italy for over 5 years. If you were still in that post, what would you be most worried about, like at the moment? Basically, the situation at the moment seems to be for this winter, we currently have relatively warm weather and high storage. So is the big problem for Europe as a whole that the price of gas staying high next winter as well, rather than actual kind of supply, or would you be worried about both?
What worries me a lot more than prices is the availability of gas. And what's worried me, I've been in the industry 20 years, and what worries me, regardless of the role I'm in as a company, is the fact that storages are misunderstood, how strategic and how important gas storage is. And the problems arise typically around February. When you think of gas storage, you should think of like air inside a football. If you puncture the football, air will get out immediately, because there's pressure inside. That's what happens in November, December, and early January. As the air goes out, as the storages become less full, the pressure in the storage is little, and so it will be harder to get the pressure you need out to keep the lights on. So what people underestimate is that the difference between a very warm day in February in Italy, but it's the same in the UK, and it's even worse in Northern Europe. A warm day in Italy, you consume about 190 million cubic meters. The same day in a cold February, you consume 460. 2.5 times more. So a week of very cold weather, we call it the beast from the east, or whatever name you attach to that very cold spell, that consumes almost as much gas as 3 or 4 normal weeks in a warmer summer. So if you do get a very cold spell in February, there simply won't be enough gas to keep the lights on in all of Europe. So you'll need to do curtailment.
So the problem there is A, that you just need a lot more if it's a lot colder for obvious reasons. But there's also, you're saying there's a kind of technical problem. It's harder to get the gas out of storage. Is that the right way to understand it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You have less gas coming out of storage. And when it's cold in Europe, at the same time everywhere. So yeah, you'll have all European countries competing for very scarcely available gas. The big risk is that countries with a nationalistic mindset close the borders for gas, that could really be a very big social and political problem for Europe. Europe was founded as a community of collaboration around coal and steel. No one is really thinking enough through the consequences of that curtailment and that border conflict for energy.
When you talk about curtailment, you mean like obviously on the continent there are everything's interconnected. So like we would, in a hypothetical example, could we see Germany or anyone but Germany saying we need this because we're in a real cold snap, we need much more gas than we thought, we're just going to not allow gas to go beyond our borders and it's just as simple as that. And I mean
that's exactly what happens. And I think the UK is the most vulnerable because the UK has basically let its storage shut down, and the UK is dependent on continental storage through the interconnections with the Netherlands and Belgium. And it's exactly how you said it. I don't want to mention what specific countries would do, but I've been in the gas industry in 2006 when there was a shortage of gas because the Ukrainians and Gazprom were disputing, having a commercial dispute. Mm-hmm. And I've seen exactly that overnight, government saying you're not allowed to, I have the gas in my country. I'm lucky and blessed to have storage in my country. I'm not going to let you export the gas.
Right. But I mean, I suppose the counter argument on that is things would have to get really, really quite dire. And I realize you're saying, it could be that dire, but things would have to get really, really dire for countries to start doing that, because if they did, that obviously then has all sorts of knock-on effects for the future. But notwithstanding that, you still see that as a kind of legitimate thing to be concerned about.
I think we are lucky to have storages full now and to have October that's been unusually warm. Mm-hmm. And let's keep the fingers crossed. Next winter is going to be harder because the storages are full of Russian gas. Essentially, that's what Europe does. Normally buys cheap Russian gas in the summer to fill up all the storages.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how we'll be able to fill the storages for next winter. But even this winter, if it gets cold, we may just be able to nudge the bullet, but it's going to be very tricky. And it doesn't need to get dire to the point of having blackouts. It needs to be a prediction of possible blackouts to really drive countries to shut the borders. And that's right. The worst case scenario.
Okay. But I suppose from a kind of corporate point of view, if you happen to be the boss of like a really big industrial player in Europe, like BASF. How would you be kind of, what is the right way to look at the current situation from where we are almost at the end of 2022? I mean, would you be kind of, you know, the dynamic you were just talking about there means that gas prices could stay really high all of next year, perhaps even longer. But at some point, you know, the price signal will have do its stuff, and gas supply in the middle of the decade is kind of due to ramp up, at least in theory. So, I mean, does that mean that it's just a case of sticking out and kind of holding on for dear life for the next, you know, year or so, but not really changing your CapEx plans? Or would you be doing that? Would you just be kind of doing a freeze on investment or what? How would you think about it?
So there will be more LNG coming, but we have to remember that China continues to grow its demand for LNG. China's adding about 15 million homes, 1.5, to their gas grid every year. They're still cooking and heating homes with coal. So China and Asia's growth in general, as they move from coal to gas, which is exactly what we're asking them to do, will continue well beyond 2050, 2060. Right. All the big European companies, they also have a obligation to decarbonize. In Germany, for example, you won't be allowed any more fossil fuels by 2043. Right. So that in itself is driving a lot of the CapEx decisions. They are trying to electrify. So a lot of companies concerned is, you know, how cheap will electricity be in the context of a high gas scenario? And I think the bright news for some of these players as they are thinking about decarbonizing and creating a more secure portfolio of energy supply is just how cheap hydrogen and its derivatives are going to be in the next decade. So I think there will be a couple of very difficult years. Progressively, as we approach the end of this decade, the availability of cheaper gas will help significantly, especially coming from Qatar. There is still a lot of uncertainty that's blocking new projects being built in America because the Europeans aren't ready to sign the long-term take-or-pay contracts because of the very uncertainties that we're talking about. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg. The Europeans are reluctant to sign 20-year long-term gas contracts. And the U.S. investors are not able to sanction the big liquefaction projects that would really help lower the cost of energy for everyone.
Okay, let's come on to that. But just for the moment, I mean, you mentioned hydrogen. You wrote a well-received book on hydrogen called The Hydrogen Revolution, which came out last year. Does the fallout, you know, given that we've had war energy crises since you published that in the middle of last year, if you were publishing it right now, would you be kind of, there be any way in which you would amend it, or would there be any way in which your argument might have changed? Thinking of things like the fact that the price of gas has gone through the roof, that does have implications for the relative cost of things like green hydrogen, right?
Yes, I've done a couple of editions already, and every time I update it, the only thing that's really moving is the timing. Things are getting massively accelerated. So projects that I thought were going to happen in 2030, 2035, now are happening in 2027. Right. So, you know, the European reaction to COVID and I think the doubling down that we're going to see early next year as a consequence of Russia and Ukraine is really the repower EU. Hydrogen is at the core of that. So the volumes that are becoming mandatory in Europe in 20, you know, kind of by 2025, by 2030, these are numbers that in my original books I had out for 2035. So there's almost a decade of acceleration.
Right. Okay. And I mean, presumably, I mean, how important is this, the cost factor there as well? Because it depends what gas price you input, but like the cost of green hydrogen relative to blue hydrogen is presumably quite a lot different, right?
So green hydrogen 15 years ago used to cost $1,000 a megawatt hour, and we have a path now to see it getting below 25 this decade.
Right.
The cost of natural gas used to be $5 a megawatt hour, and now it's up, you know, has been up to 250. It's now back down in the high hundreds, but that's because it's very warm and storages are full.
Right.
So you have, as you've mentioned, between blue and green, but even just hydrogen compared to fossil gas, notwithstanding the CO2 advantages, you've had this incredible switch, and hydrogen, there's going to be a bump due to inflation and supply chain issues with all renewables and everything else, every other commodity and product. But as we get past this bump, the trajectory is just down, and molecules are going to get more and more expensive as we run out of the cheaper reservoirs of the world. So the trajectory, I mean, that inversion has already happened, and hydrogen is already cheaper than fossil gas today.
Right. Yeah. No, but that's
another in Europe. Another
topic I was going to ask you about. I mean, your latest role is chief executive of TES, H2, which is aiming to scale up green hydrogen, and I just from a kind of, again, from a kind of corporate perspective, like, how does it feel to be a, you know, renewables company right now? Because, you know, a couple of years ago we had this bubble in green stocks, which is kind of the air has gone out of it. But I just wondered, what's the kind of biggest challenge for the sector? Would you be most worried about overzealous windfall taxes? Would you be worried about rising rates and the impact on the valuations of renewable projects, or the supply chain bottlenecks we're talking about, or the fact that EU and UK regulators may be a bit too distracted to kind of give you the attention that you need at this point in time? What's the biggest problem, do you think?
So thank you for mentioning TESS. The one thing I would add to my Hydrogen Revolution book and narrative is exactly what TESS is doing. So we are converting green hydrogen to green methane. So we're producing what we call ENG. It's electric natural gas. It's a completely renewable LNG. So this is being massively accelerated by the current energy crisis. The project that we were hoping to start in 2027, 2028 in Germany, we're building Europe's largest regas terminal for the importing of this green hydrogen. That's been accelerated to 2023. So we're starting next year with the floating regasifier. So the support, the political support and regulatory support, I think, is there. You mentioned the supply chain issues. Those are very real. With the IRA in America, the Inflation Reduction Act, a lot of the suppliers are moving their order books to the US. And what Europe should really do and the UK should do is really support the building of new factories for electrolyzers, for solar panels, for electric cables, because that's what's going to be the real bottleneck. As the new energy becomes a lot more widely available and cheaper, the bottleneck is not in the availability of financing, in the availability of the demand, in availability of land, in the availability of sun and wind. The bottleneck is just in the availability of the equipment to put on the deserts or in the high waters.
Interesting. So, what is needed is for the regulators and the public sector it's not even like they need to kind of provide finance or kind of, you know, it's like the finance is there, it's just they need to provide what, like the kind of permit
policy, I call it policy nudges, to create the frameworks and say, okay, you know, backstops, create some guarantees, some backstop orders, get the factories going. The private sector will get there, but I think the policymakers have really a chance to fast track it by 10, 15 years. If we look at what happened with solar, UK, Germany, Spain, and Italy, these four countries single-handedly put about €1,000 billion of subsidies on our bills. You remember the very expensive solar and wind subsidies. That resulted in China building about 6 big factories to manufacture solar panels. And after 15 years, the cost of solar went from 1,000 to 10 euros per megawatt hour. So we, you know, these four countries saved the world, reduced the price for everyone. Each of those factories will probably cost between $500 million and $1 billion. So with $3 to $6 billion of capex on a factory, you could have probably gotten to the same result.
Right.
So let's start with the end in mind. Let's start manufacturing this infrastructure. Let's turn this into an opportunity for new technologies, new jobs, new energy security. And let's use these technologies to go into places like Namibia, like Egypt, like Morocco, like Australia, like Texas, Mexico, right, where there's a lot of space, a lot of land, a lot of sun, and use these European technologies to bring the sun home and turn it into very low cost molecules.
Yeah, but I suppose just again picking up again what something you said a bit earlier, but are you concerned that the EU and UK or just the European regulatory like headspace is, I mean, I it's pretty obvious why they would be focused on the energy crisis at the moment, but do you think that's happening a bit too much and there's not enough focus on those kind of things that you're talking about that need to happen to grow the renewables in the way that everyone wants? What could be that they be doing differently, do you think?
I think we need to get out of the old idea of just pouring hundreds of billions of euros on these things. It's much more about realizing that there's a lot of liquidity. The private markets are functioning. If you just look at the cash on the balance sheet of the oil and gas companies, if you look at the cash available in the Middle East, there's no lack of appetite for the right investments. Policymakers should really focus on the pain points, on the tipping points, on the triggers. And those are around, you know, creating the contracts for difference, creating the backstop undertaking. Yeah, but it's not subsidies that require hundreds of billions. It should be smart subsidies where you give some nudges and you focus on really what makes a difference. And I think it's around manufacturing, it's around creating some hubs, it's around focus on the technologies that don't require to change the whole system, that don't require a complete overhaul of everything that we've done. And I think low carbon gases, clean gases, and e-gases are one of the paths forward. Right. You know, a very successful policy in Europe has been the biofuels directive. Europe and the UK was still part of Europe, made it mandatory to blend into our cars growing percentages of e-diesel. You know, right. That was a policy decision. Didn't cost governments a penny. People didn't see it as a tax. And it created a massive market for biofuels. That right. type of enlightened policy is what's needed.
Interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, you will have seen RWE did a recent deal with Con Edison in the US, and that was partly prompted by some of the advantages and the subsidies that come from the Inflation Reduction Act that you mentioned. And I just wondered, I mean, you mentioned that supply chains, suppliers maybe kind of redirecting their attention to the US. It's all part of the same thing. I mean, how much of a, how big an effect do you think that will be? And how much of a problem is that for Europe and the UK? I mean, in terms of trying to develop their own green industry and green sectors.
So I think China is, as I mentioned, leading the way, because China is building their own supply chain and their own market, and they're really serious about it. And I think Europe and the US either agree to build a joint supply chain, but if Europe and the US start competing through subsidies, that's just a very expensive and inefficient way to go about it.
Right.
So right now you have European companies not investing in Europe, moving to the US because the subsidies there are greater. Then even within Europe, you have Germany that has the highest war chest and firepower, committing to putting a lot more capital on this than other European countries. So I really hope Europe can at least get their subsidies on a par. I think this is quite bipartisan in the sense that renewable subsidies and carbon storage subsidies in the US were there even with the Republicans. So I don't think it's a question of unwinding some particular subsidies. I think when it comes to EVs, that's been more politicized in the US as an issue, electric vehicles. But I think for the kind of decarbonization of heavy industry, it's the consumers that are asking it. If you look at Amazon, you know, a lot of these Nike, a lot of US companies have made pledges to be net zero by 2040. So there's a real market there. And I think even the you know, it's not just a democratic thing, but I do think Europe needs to accelerate the definition of its own subsidies and find ways to collaborate with the US.
Right. Okay. But like, is there a how easy is that going to be to kind of set up a US EU supply chain? I mean, it sounds like what you're suggesting is that because China is doing all that itself, you know, we just need to have as big a block as possible. An alternative block also doing that. I mean, do the people you speak to and think that's a feasible thing to have a kind of joined up supply chain or joined up market for US and EU renewables?
It's very challenging. You will see increasing calls for carbon border adjustments, and the elephant in the room is what happens around steel and very heavy industry, and what happens around trade of green steel, and how will you create the market for green steel? You'll need to protect the import of non-green steel. So I think it's a bigger discussion than simply manufacturing of solar panels and electrolyzers and subsidies. I think that discussion hasn't started yet, and that is likely to dominate the EU-US dialogue in the coming couple of years.
Yeah. But I mean, I suppose just in the round, what do all the various topics we've discussed do for geopolitical power dynamics like this decade? We're talking about by 2030, you look at all this stuff in the round. Do you see kind of, you know, Europe will be out the other side of the energy crisis, being a good place because it's no longer dependent on Russian fossil fuels, and it may have a hot head start on clean energy. Who knows? Or will it just, you know, replace reliance on Russia with dependence on somebody else, either for the US LNG or Chinese raw materials, or what? I mean, it's a quite sprawling question, but I'm just interested in your thoughts.
So the US, if you just look in the next 10 years, just projecting current trends, whichever part of the political spectrum you're on, it's hard to see the US having excess cash. There will be a fiscal tightening of some sort. Europe already has a head start, and Europe is seen globally as the market for renewable energy, just because people understand it's more than a political issue. It's a real commitment to actually getting to zero. And I think China, as I said, sees it the same way, sees getting to zero as a real strategic advantage in what will inevitably be a decarbonized world, at least for where the big markets are. A lot of the political or geopolitical weight is going to shift, let's say, back to the Middle East. When I say back, you know, there's just so much liquidity available in the Middle East. And so you'll see Qatar playing a very big role. You'll see the UAE and Saudi playing a very big role on electricity and on hydrogen. And I think the big challenge is what will happen in Africa and who will provide that energy to Africa. And my bet is that a lot of Middle Eastern capital with European technology will be very active in Africa, both to provide clean energy to Europe, but to Africa itself, which, if you just look at the demographics of what's happening in Nigeria, in Tanzania, in Congo, these, you know, 10 of the world's biggest countries this century will be in Africa. And just the energy challenge and the climate challenge there is very significant. So I'm quite optimistic for Europe. I think this war is accelerating the path to a journey of building infrastructure that I call forever infrastructure. Once I've connected the sun of Morocco with the UK with an electric cable, for example, that connection is permanent. It's not part of the energy transition. That's going to be there forever. And the marginal cost of the sun and the wind is zero. So that infrastructure will deliver reliable, clean, but also energy that gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And the faster we do this, this is the only chance for Europe to keep manufacturing alive, because the alternative is for people to stop heavy industry in Europe and just put the heavy industry investments where the sun is.
Yeah.
So our motto is PPWS, which stands for put the panels where it's sunny. And we should put the panels where it's sunny and bring the energy to Europe to avoid the factories moving to where it's sunny.
Right. I mean, just from the Middle Eastern point of view, you mentioned that, I mean, they currently sell a lot of their fossil fuels to the Far East and Asia. If we project out to, you know, a decade from now, I mean, do you think they will be kind of playing a big role in clean energy, but to Europe, or to kind of helping that dynamic develop? And do you think increasingly Europe is a big market for the Middle East, partly because of LNG, but also clean energy as well?
Yeah, Yeah, we're working with a number of players there, both state owned enterprises and private sector, and they're all looking at Europe with a lot of interest. And there's a lot of competition in the Middle East to serve Europe with clean energy. And if you look at the world's biggest renewable projects, the world's biggest hydrogen projects are all happening in the Middle East right now.
Right. So that's a potential growth market for them, and a new source of power for other people. I mean, just picking up on one thing you said earlier about specifically about LNG, maybe could you just expand on that, the dynamic between Europe and the US at the moment? Because I think the issue is that Europe really wants LNG as much as possible to come from somewhere to replace what they're getting from Russia, but they don't want to be paying too
So
exalted rates. So what is the dynamic at the moment?
it's somewhat frustrating because Europe, including the UK, will pay about 1,000 billion euros of extra energy costs this year compared to a normal year. And the governments are reacting by putting government money to try to lower the impact of this on consumers, in the case of Germany, also on industry. And so the governments in Europe have already committed hundreds of billions to try to mitigate the impact of this. But they're doing so in a way that doesn't address the issue structurally. This is like pouring mineral water on a wildfire. With a fraction of those investments or just commitments, you could build 30 million tons of US liquefaction capacity. It could be up and running in 3 years, and even sooner if you took a warlike development efforts, fast tracking the permits, etc. And that would structurally solve Europe's LNG issues, lowering the price in a much more meaningful and sustainable way. That would only require something like 50 billion euros of CapEx, and this CapEx lasts for 25 years. So if you look at the annual amount, it's a fraction of what we're spending. So there are things that Europe could have done and could do, and is not doing because of short-termism, which is somewhat frustrating. Also for our American colleagues who have the land there, have the permits already in place, can't take FID, can't sanction their projects because no one in Europe is willing to underwrite these commitments.
Right. But would you say that wouldn't that have involved like Europe giving money or subsidizing LNG terminals in the US in order to make that happen? Or I mean, what could Europe have done to I mean, as you say, they're spending all that money at the moment to cushion the blow, but your point is that they could have just picked up that money and somehow improved the flow of LNG. Is that that's your point, isn't it?
Well, my point is that the market will be there for LNG. It's just companies, because they're facing their own pressing short-term issues, and because of the regulatory and political uncertainty around fossil fuels, companies aren't able to sign now new long-term contracts. Without the new long-term contracts, the people aren't building the liquefaction infrastructure in the US. Europe could send a signal saying, we will underwrite the capacity, build the terminals, and the gas will flow. If for whatever reason the gas won't flow, we'll still pay the capacity, which is just an insurance policy. It's a tiny fraction of the money that is being poured right now just to lower people's bills.
So,
And
a smarter European political strategy would do something like that rather than
well,
spending
I
a trillion or whatever
it's
on.
It's very basic. This is a crisis of molecules. This is a crisis of supply and demand. And you can reduce demand only to a certain point, but then you have to, it becomes really politically painful to reduce demand further. And you start losing jobs and you start having to curtail energy. No one's really focused on supply. No one's focused on building the right infrastructure as fast as possible to rebalance supply and demand. And that's what needs to happen. And what we're doing at TESS allows people to consider LNG infrastructure no longer a stranded asset, but increasingly a forever asset, because we can use exactly the same infrastructure we would build now to bring in fossil shale gas from America, tomorrow to bring in a clean hydrogen from Texas using exactly the same terminals, exactly the same ships.
Okay, well, that has been a really, really interesting chat. Thanks so much for joining us, Marco.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. This podcast was produced by Oliver Tashlich in London. Subscribe to The Exchange and our sister podcast, The Views Room, on Acast, Megaphone, or wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our latest views on breakingviews.com and on Twitter, where our handle is @breakingviews.